Welcome to Odd Dog Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordock. Meg Inokuma is a quiet and determined woman who has set course records in ultra-distance events such as the Susitna 100, Winter Running Race, the Resurrection Pass 100, and the White Mountain 100. She also won the Equinox Marathon in 2002 at the age of 42. Her story is of a late bloomer becoming one of Alaska's best endurance athletes. She joins me to discuss her path to Alaska, fighting and overcoming health issues, and running some of the hardest, coldest races anywhere. We talk about her training, nutrition, balancing work and her running passion, her love of Alaska's mountains, and what inspires her. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer. Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordock, and I have endurance athlete and mountain runner Meg Inokuma with me in the studio today. Welcome to the show, Meg.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
I'm very excited. You are such an accomplished athlete, and I know you don't necessarily like titles, but it's pretty impressive what you've done, and we'll get into that in a bit. But first, I want to have you talk a little bit about your story, how you came to Alaska, how you got into running, and tell us the Alaska story.
I grew up in Japan, and first I came to Alaska as my first overseas trip.
Oh, nice.
And I fell in love with it, and ever since then, I wanted to move to Alaska.
Yeah.
But as a kid, there's not much I could do. So, yeah, I went to school there, and yeah.
Was it a family trip that you did?
Yes.
Yeah.
We just did touristy stuff, just drove around. We didn't really do much exploring.
Oh, yeah. And when what year was that, may I ask?
I think it's 1987.
Okay, so 87. So the pipeline boom was sort of over, but things have changed a lot in Alaska since 1987.
I'm sure. Yeah. I don't remember much. I remember the glacier was a lot larger.
The glaciers were larger. They sure were back then. And what were your parents outdoorsy people? Like, how did you, what sparked your interest in the outdoors?
Yeah, they were into some mountaineering, but nothing crazy. We did hiking every weekend.
That's about it.
Yes.
And we're in Japan?
Not too far from Tokyo, but not a big city. Yeah. There are lots of trails and lakes, and it's a beautiful place.
I'm always interested in that because it seems like adults who I talk to who are interested in the outdoors had positive experiences in the outdoors growing up as kids. Is that the same for you?
I think so.
Yeah. you obviously somehow continued with it. And then, so you visited that first visit, and then how did you end up here?
After that, I was always thinking about Alaska, but I just went to school like other kids. And in middle school, I was in track team. I was running 800 meters and 1500 meters. And then in high school, just like lots of other Japanese kids, I was studying a lot all day.
Yeah.
But in high school, I picked up more mountaineering, more skills.
Oh, interesting.
Let's say, in summer. Mm-hmm. And then I went to undergrad in Tokyo. I was in a bicycle racing team. I started with mountain bike racing and transitioned to road bike racing. And then eventually I started a bicycle messenger in Tokyo as a side job.
Yeah.
It was exciting, and I quit racing.
Talk to me about that. Like, what was exciting? Like, just because of traffic? And I can't really, I've seen those people, not necessarily in Anchorage, but in big cities, and that sounds crazy.
It's crazy. It's retrospect. It's really dangerous job. I don't want to go back and do it again, but it's exciting.
Yeah.
You can go faster than cars.
yeah, in a big city. Yeah. I was just in Chicago and watching them ride their bikes around. I was like, well, that's nuts. But yeah.
Yeah. So after I finished my undergrad in Tokyo, I moved to Arizona for my first grad school.
Mm-hmm. And what were your degrees in?
I studied forestry.
Okay. So more outdoor related.
Sort of.
Yeah.
And you might wonder what kind of sports I did there, but I didn't do anything.
Uh-huh.
I didn't really speak English when I got there. So I pretty much studied 20 hours a day, and that took all my life there.
Oh, huh. But you stayed, did you still run? Did you do stuff in the outdoors, or you just...
No, I didn't have time.
You didn't have time. Oh, wow.
I did go rock climbing here and there, but not a lot.
Right. I'm interested in the learning, the mountaineering part and learning. So that was that part of the curriculum, something that children do in Japan? Did they learn mountaineering and outdoor skills as part of, secondary education?
No, but in high school, in summer, it was not required, but I did some school trips, whoever wanted to go.
Okay, yeah.
During the summer vacation.
Right, yeah, but you got introduced to it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're in school in Arizona with studying forestry. Then what?
Then I slowly moved my way up to Alaska.
Uh-huh.
And I moved to Kodiak in 2008.
Okay. And was that for work?
I was married at the time, and it was his job.
Okay. All right. And what was your impression of Kodiak?
I loved it.
Yeah. What part of it?
The community is so small. Like, everybody help each other. And it wasn't just me who didn't have big family like parents there in Japan, but right, lots of people who live in Kodiak, their family is like lower 48. So I didn't feel I was different.
Right, right. A very welcoming community.
Yes.
Right. Everybody's sort of new. So.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And while in Kodiak then, did you pick up, like, when did the running sort of come back to you after school?
I was running. I did running race and bike race and, yeah, some other fun races too.
Yeah.
It was different from how I do now, but I was racing.
Right. And I think about running and racing and Kodiak. I mean, everybody thinks about bears. What were some of the sort of challenges of running in Kodiak? Was that one of them?
I didn't feel I was scared of bear there.
Yeah.
There are lots of fish and lots of berries, and
right,
they were always occupied.
Right. They weren't hungry.
That was my impression anyways.
Right.
I survived.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Kodiak, and then what was the next step after that?
And then I moved to the mainland. Yeah. I had some nomadic life.
Uh-huh.
Winter. I had a summer job in Soldotna. I was driving boat every day, all day, in Kenai River, which was fun. Uh-huh. But that was only summer. And eventually I went back to school for a second master's degree in statistics at UAF.
Okay. Oh, wow. Uh-huh. The driving the boat on the Kenai, was that fishing or was that, what were you?
I was doing survey.
Surveying work. Okay. So not necessarily tourism, but yeah. So then a statistics degree, that sounds intense, getting into tweeting stats. So then what was your next step?
That's when my friend Tracy Curry,
mm-hmm, yep,
dragged me to the event, Drew Harrington's talk about ultra running, which I didn't even know the meaning of ultra.
Ultra running, right, yeah.
And yeah, that was the introduction, even though I had zero interest in ultra running back then.
So this is in Fairbanks. So
yes.
So you went to that event, and then something must have got your interest.
Not at the time, but interestingly, some of the words that Drew talked still stick in my head, and I feel like I should run his race at some point. I haven't done the Drew's, what is that called? I don't remember.
Yeah, right. But you got interested in it. Now, I know you, so you're back into running at this point, and was that during your grad school era? Were you thinking about the marathon? I know the Equinox Marathon, it's one of the oldest marathons in North America, and it's got a long history.
I wasn't racing at all around that time.
Mm-hmm.
I did join some like weekly running group, but no, I was not fast, or I was not thinking about race at all.
Yeah.
I didn't know at the time, but I was very anemic.
Oh, right. Right. And so what was that like? Like you're anemic. Explain that, what that means, and how you figured that out?
So I just thought that I was out of shape because I was studying a lot and I wasn't exercising a lot. Yeah. So after I finished school, I moved to Palmer and started going to Lazy. And I realized that I'm like a lot slower than anybody on the trail. And I still thought that I was just out of shape. Yeah. But it turned out later, I don't know when I found that, probably in the fall, I got the blood test done and realized that my hemoglobin level is very low.
And Lazy Mountain, that when you talked about on Lazy, you were talking about the Lazy Mountain
Trail. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And that explain that trail a little bit to folks who aren't familiar with it.
Lazy Mountain, it's right by Palmer. It's conveniently located. I think it's the mountain does not have any approach section. You know, the Anchorage Trails mountains has approach section. You kind of go flat for a while and then start going uphill. Lazy Mountain is different. There's a trailhead and you start going up.
Straight
so
up.
So if you're not getting exercise, it's very efficient.
Right, yeah, yeah. And they have, a while back they put another trail, the Lazy Moose, I think is what it's called, which is much more accessible and lower angle. But yeah, the old trail pretty much goes straight up and down.
Yes.
So you did the Equinox while you're anemic. Is that right?
I did not actually. I did not do Equinox when I lived in Fairbanks.
Okay. Yeah. And so what then? So you're back in Palmer now. And so what were some of your first races that you did here in Alaska?
I did Crazy Lazy. I think it was 2019. I didn't know anything about the race until probably a week before that.
Uh-huh.
But I was chatting with my friend, and she just suggested that, why don't you do this? And I did it. I think that was the first race after anemia.
Yeah. And explain that race to folks. What? How far is it? What's the route? That kind of thing.
It's a 6 miles and about 3,000 feet elevation gain.
Wow.
And 3,000 elevation loss.
Yeah.
It's go up Lazy, the steep side, and go down to Map Peak Trail and take a horse trail back to the trailhead.
Yeah.
It's a loop.
Right. And how did that go for you, that first one?
I don't remember a lot, but I enjoyed it and I met a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And is that part of what do you enjoy? We'll get into a little bit more of the why and all this later, but is that, I always think of running as sort of a solo adventure, but is that something you enjoy, like being with other people and the social aspect of it?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, different, one of the big differences between peak bagging and racing.
Right. And so now you're in Palmer and you did the one race. And now I just want to, we'll learn the introduction of some of your other events, but you've done the Chugach 100, which is more of a peak bagging thing. You've been on Mount Marathon. You've done a Mount Marathon race. Lots of events here. So it seems to have accelerated after that, right, your racing. So you must have enjoyed it. What were your next steps after the Crazy Lazy race?
After that, I wanted to do Lost Lake.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was Swan Lake Fire.
Oh,
or
right.
The big fire.
So yeah, it was 2019.
The
yeah.
race was canceled.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do that as a celebration of me getting over anemia.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. So I was a little disappointed.
Yeah.
And probably a week or so later, I found this Equinox that I never even looked at. So I just signed up and did it.
Yeah, and that is quite the race. I've done it a bunch, and it was my first marathon also.
Oh, wow.
with sort of knowing what was it, but not fully understanding how hard it is. Explain that race to the listeners.
It start as kind of rolling hill and go up. I don't even know what the elevation gain is, but go up a wider trail and down some steep chute, and there was some pavement section, and finish with some rolling hill.
Yeah. It goes up a couple thousand feet at least, and it it's quite the event. And you did pretty well, right? On that, I don't know if the first one you did, but eventually you got on a podium there, right?
Not in that race.
Right.
Eventually.
Right. So, but that must have triggered something in you to, like, say, I want to do these longer races. You must have enjoyed it.
Yeah, it linked to next step, actually. I just started going to Monday night hiking group based in Chugach just around that time. And there are lots of ultra runners in there that I didn't know when I started going. But a couple of them, Martin and Ed, were talking about Susitna 100, which I had never heard of. So I asked them, what are you guys talking about? And they're, you're invited, by the way. And I didn't know much about it, but there wasn't any reason not to, so I did it.
Nice.
That ended up, that was my first ultra.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Torlak. We have Meg Inokuma with me talking about her running and peat bagging career, which is full of some amazing events and accomplishments. So talk to us about the Susitna 100. It's in the winter, correct?
It's in winter.
Yeah.
And you pull sled because there are lots of requirement gear to carry, like 20 below sleeping bag.
Yeah, right.
So, it went, it did not go pretty.
Oh, no.
But I survived and I didn't lose my toe and fingers and I barely, but I finished. It went, I really enjoyed the first maybe 55 miles. I didn't see any runner between like mile 10 and mile 54-ish. Mm-hmm. I was by myself. I had no idea of anybody in front of me or who's behind me.
Oh.
But then my knee started bothering me.
Oh, no.
So I slowed down and then... Yeah, I got to this checkpoint around mile 64, and I stopped there for a couple hours for no reason, and that was a big mistake. When you stop after you get slightly injured leg, it starts swelling.
Oh, no.
So after that, it was survival. The temperature went down much colder than the forecasted. The forecast was, I think it said like 5 below or something is the coldest. Well, that night, it turned out that it went down to 20 below.
Oh, boy.
You didn't have a lot of stuff. I should have worn my sleeping bag, but I wasn't that smart. And next checkpoint, I stayed another 2 hours. And by then, a couple of guys caught up with me and a few women caught up with me. And they left. And seeing sunrise encouraged me to finally get out of the checkpoint. Even though the checkpoint volunteers, they try so hard to kick me out for 2 hours. But for the rest, I just walked. That was the introduction to my ultra.
Well, but you finished.
I did.
Good. Did you go back and do it again?
I did. I did go back. Two other time. I did three Susitna. That's actually Susitna 100 is actually my probably most favorite race. And I don't want to say anything too big, but I'd like to finish 10 times.
Oh, good. And how many times are you at now?
Just three.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. That's very doable. Yeah. Do you, and what's the difference? So that was a winter race. Now, I also noticed another big race you did was the Resurrection Pass 100. Is that summer or winter?
It's in summer. It's the end of July.
Okay. And what is that race? Where does it go? Where does it start? What's the route?
Resurrection Trail, probably a lot of people know Resurrection Trail in Kenai. It starts in Hope. You go up towards town 2 miles and come back just to add 4 miles. And then you run Resurrection Pass Trail all the way to Cooper Landing and then go back up to Devil's Pass Junction and then go down to Devil's Creek Trailhead all the way and come back up.
Oh, boy.
And then go back to Hope Trailhead.
Oh, boy. Boy, that must be tough coming back up from to Devil's Pass. Yeah.
It's exciting. You know, some people don't like out and back route, but I... What? kind of like to see other people because otherwise I might not see anyone.
Oh, yeah. And you did that. And how many times have you done that, Riz?
I've done 100 twice and 50 twice.
Okay. Oh, huh. And how did you do?
100 or 50?
The 100.
100. I did okay.
Yeah.
Both times. I'm satisfied with how I did. But conditions were not the greatest. It was cold. I was soaking wet from start to finish.
Oh boy, cold and wet. That sounds a little dangerous.
I mean, it's cold because I was wet, I guess.
Oh, right,
I should
right,
say.
Right, okay.
Because so the trail is so overgrown, and after both years it started with rain, but rain stopped right away.
What?
But because all the brushes are wet, it's like
right,
you're in a car wash 20 hours.
No matter the rain here, you still get really wet. Yeah. And what is the difference between? So you did. I'm interested in the difference between the Sisseton 100 and which is in the summer or in the winter, and the Chugach 100, which is in the summer. Like for instance, were your times? I know that's not probably super relatable because one's more mountainous than the other. But do you feel like your energy output? I would assume it's more in the winter. Is that correct? Especially at minus 20, you're probably putting out a lot more energy.
It's different in many ways, so it's hard to compare. So Sedna, as I said, there's required gear. So most runners pull sled.
Yeah.
So it's a lot heavier. And winter condition can vary probably more than summer ultras because if it's warmer, snow's soft, and you're post-hauling away.
Uh-huh, yeah.
As my very first year, it was cold year and not a lot of snow. So it was like ice, which is fast for running.
Mm-hmm.
And the other difference is in winter, in Sisseton, I usually fall asleep when I'm running. You can kind of run.
What's that? Never heard of that.
Well, you just kind of take a nap while you're running. But
wait. How do you stay upright? How does that work?
Not longer than a minute.
Oh, okay.
But it works.
A minute's a long time.
Maybe 30 seconds. I don't know. Right. I don't time.
Okay. But it seems like a minute.
Yeah, and it works.
Yeah.
It's refreshing.
Uh-huh.
But there's no way I would do it in Resurrection Pass. There are lots of trip hazard.
Oh.
In winter, in snow, it's flat. To begin with, it's just snow. If you fall, it doesn't really, there's not much consequence.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wouldn't do that in Res Pass.
So which was harder? And on average, you've done both a bunch of times. Which do you think is harder? The winter 100 or the summer 100?
It's just different.
It's different, yeah. Because it sounds like you have to be more focused in the summer one while you're running.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, in summer, in Resurrection Pass, because of this overgrown and lots of trip hazard and you can't really see the trail because of the brush, it's harder to keep eating. I like to keep eating. Like, I don't calculate calorie or do, like, once every hour or once every 30. I like to keep eating. Like, I'd say, like, a bite every 10 minutes or something, which I can do in winter, but I cannot really do in Res Pass.
Because of
the visibility and trip hazard.
Right, huh. So that's super interesting. And we'll get back to sort of your training and nutrition in a little bit. What other, so let's talk a little bit. So you're doing these races. Now, what about the peat bagging? How'd that get started? How'd you start into that?
When I was still living in Kodiak, at the end of my Kodiak life, I spent a couple of winters in like South Central, like mainland Alaska, and I got a winter job in Anchorage. And that season, I went to Alaska Rock Gym every day, and I met this guy who was doing this Chugach 120. But, of course, I was still spending most of my year in Kodiak, and I was there only for a few months in winter in Chugach State Park area. So I couldn't do it. I didn't start doing it. So when I moved to Palmer, finally, after I finished school in Fairbanks, I just started doing it.
And so, did that require any extra? Describe peat bagging to me. It doesn't involve technical climbing, does it, or does it?
Some of them does. At least you want to be able to, but you want to know how to navigate glacier and, of course, avalanche hazard or rockfall hazard.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of skills that you learn as you do, too.
Right. And how did you go about learning those things?
I started rock climbing when I was in Tokyo, and I took avalanche class when I was in Kodiak. Mm-hmm. I did take Alaska Mountaineering School. I think it was 12 days mountaineering course when I was doing Kodiak.
Uh-huh.
The course was in Alaska Range, not in Kodiak.
Yeah.
So I got the basic in those official courses.
So I took some classes.
Yes.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, we'll get back to that, sort of your training and preparation after this break. You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Torlett. We have Meg Amakuma in the studio with me, and we'll be right back after this quick break.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordak. I am talking with Meg Inokuma in the studio with me about her amazing running and peat bagging career. So we before the break, Meg, we were talking about peat bagging. And so you've been working away at the Two Guys 100, is that right?
Yes, and 120.
120. And explain, we've had shows on this before. Other guests have talked about the different variations of the Two Guys 100, 120, you know, whatever it is. So explain the 120 to us. What does that mean?
So within Chugach State Park, there are 120 peaks that has 500 feet or more prominent.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so the goal is to do all those 120.
Yes.
And where are you at with it?
99.
Okay. And what do you find attractive to that? It's sort of like an ultimate peak bagging, you know, goal to do all those peaks.
I just really enjoy views that I have never seen.
Ah.
So I do have this list of Chugach 120, but I outside of Chugach State Park, Kenai or Talkeetna's, if the weather's better there, I'll just go peak bagging there.
Ah, so it's the view.
Yes, mainly. Yeah. Uh-huh. And I like just the time with my friends too.
Uh-huh. And so let's get into a little bit. So we got this ultra, the passion of doing ultras, and now peat bagging that you have. Why? What's your motivations to do all this? It's a lot of work in life to stay in shape and do this stuff.
That's just a part of my life.
Yeah.
It's my lifestyle. I feel like it's more than hobby.
Right. Now, you talked about being sick at one point and overcoming that with anemia. What role did that play in your attitude toward this?
That earlier I mentioned that I used to run races in Kodiak, and now I do races differently. I think the change is from my experience being anemic. Mm-hmm. After I got over anemia, I realized how amazing it is to have a healthy body, and who knows how long I can stay healthy. So while I'm healthy, I want to do what I can with my 100%.
Uh-huh. So sort of being motivated a little bit, but like not a bucket list, but just trying to stay active and keep busy. And do you think the, how about, are they intertwined? Does the, I assume all the fitness also keeps you healthy, right?
Yes.
Yeah, right. And how do you prevent, I think about injuries, and how do you train? Do you have a plan at all, or how do you prevent injuries?
I do not have any training plan at all.
Love it, yeah.
for race, I do train for Susitna 100, and I did train for Map Peak Challenge. But otherwise, in general, I just stay active, and that's about all I do.
Right.
As far as physical preparation for race, I do prepare for race. Mentally, I try to be stress-free as much as possible before race.
Smart. Yeah.
As far as injury, I don't remember when the last time I did not have any injury.
Oh, boy.
But I only have one permanent injury. Yeah, I think just one, which is my right wrist.
Right. Back to the injury thing. I mean, you must have some thought of prevention. I mean, do you stretch? Do you, how about nutrition and hydration? And do you have any thoughts on that or suggestions for people?
I like eating. I've always liked to eat. So this, I don't know. Just eat whatever you want. Whenever you want. I eat like every 2 hours as soon as I wake up until I go to bed. I don't know if it's healthy. I just like to eat. As far as drinking, I'm not good at drinking water. So I try to remind myself to drink water.
But leading up to a race, are you doing carbohydrates or do you just do what you normally do?
I just do what I normally do.
Right. Good. Well, good. And during races then, you mentioned earlier that during the winter you can constantly snap and the summer races you can't, do that. Let's talk about the summer races a little bit. Are you eating every hour? Or how, if you're not constantly eating because you're worried about tripping, what are you doing? What's your strategy there?
Just whenever I can, I eat.
Okay. And how much?
I don't know. I do have a spreadsheet that I wrote down after the race, which is probably not very accurate, but I don't know on top of my head.
Okay.
But I usually eat shortbread cookies a lot. That's my main calorie source.
Okay, well, that's where I was going next, yeah.
I like real food. I don't use goo or take electrolytes. I just go with real food and water.
Oh, interesting.
Which I consider cookies real food.
Yeah. Some people would argue with that, but I don't. So in the training, and you mentioned running in a group of people. Is that something you still do? Or hiking, I guess? Yeah.
No, that group is not ongoing right now.
Okay. Right. But do you have training partners, or are you more like go off and do it by yourself?
I don't really do group being like regularly. I don't.
Yeah. Well, so you're off on your own, and we talked a little bit about. So it seems to me like the peak bagging is a little different than mountain running. I mean, there's obviously a lot of crossover. And how do you balance those two in their entire life to do this? I mean, it's amazing what you've done. So you're obviously out there exercising a lot in the outdoors. How do you do that balance of work and running, which is definitely different than climbing? So how do you balance all that?
I struggle, and the struggle is real. I wish I could do both. Every year, this last few years, I keep saying that, okay, this is going to be my last year racing, and I keep going back racing. I mentioned that I don't train for a specific race, except for Susitna and Map Peak Challenge. For example, springtime, from March through May is like spring mountaineering season. I focus. I don't think anything about race. Mm-hmm. And then often I mentally it kind of changed from mountaineering peak bagging to race mm-hmm. around June. But I still like to do both. So like, for example, last year before Resurrection Pass 100, after Mount Marathon, I did a Resurrection Pass high traverse. Mm-hmm. So my friend and I went up to from Hope to Hope Point and mm-hmm. stayed on the ridge and got out Devil's Creek Trail, which is a backpacking trip. We thought about doing it as a fastbacking, but we ended up bringing real tent, which was, I'm so glad we did because of the amount of mosquito alive. But yeah, that was like, I don't know, probably like 60 miles and just less than 30,000 feet elevation gain. So that's a peak bagging. We're hitting the peaks.
Yeah.
But I hope that it'll translate to some training for Res Pass 100, even though we were not running.
Yeah.
So yeah, I changed the type of peak that I do based on what race is coming, but I still like to get peaks in between races.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. You mentioned a word I'm not familiar with, fast packing.
Yeah.
What's that?
You go like minimalist. You might not carry real tent or big sleeping bag, but maybe you carry a super light sleeping bag in your like a little big running pack and do overnight.
So you're bivouacking out without a tent.
Right.
You're sleeping out of a tent, but so you're still, okay, huh, interesting. So you're peat bagging in the summer, you're doing the peat bagging, I'm sorry, in the spring, it sounds like, mostly, and then more training for running in the summertime. Let's talk about the seasons a little bit. What happens in the fall then? Are you out running, or do you ever take a break, I guess? Some people take a little time off once in a while. Do you ever do that? Go biking or something, or something different?
Yeah. I bike throughout the year here and there. Yeah. I don't plan ahead. Uh-huh. I don't know. I don't consider my daily activity as training, so I guess I don't take a break.
Uh-huh. Good. Yeah, well, good. Let's talk a little bit about the general idea of I want to get back to this idea of some of the things that you've done and because you've sounds like it's just part of a lifestyle but on one hand but I have a hard time believing it's entirely like you just do like say oh I'm gonna go run not the ones you train for but like for instance you got some records here that we've mentioned earlier, White Mountain 100, Res Pass 100 we've talked about. Let's say the White Mountain 100, that's a winter race, is that right?
Yes.
And so you just went off and did that? You decide one day I'm going to go do that? Or do you, like what kind of preparation do you get into that to actually get on a podium for something like that?
I did White Mountain 100 4 weeks after Susitna 100.
Okay.
So I decided I was already in shape.
Yeah. Yeah. So you just went out and did it.
Yeah.
Right. And what was that like, the White Mountain 100?
It was my first 100 mile other than Susitna. And White Mountain does not have required gear. So it's different. You are carrying everything in your pack.
Uh-huh.
So I really try to focus on making the gear light because when I'm dragging a sled, it doesn't really matter. A pound doesn't matter a lot.
Uh-huh.
But if you're carrying everything in your back, you want to make it as light as possible and small as possible.
Yeah.
So that was a challenge. And White Mountain, I was hearing there would be a lot of overflow. So prepared. I make some gear so that my leg won't get soaked, even though I ended up getting soaked because I stepped on ice that broke through.
Wow, all the way?
To just under my knee, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what'd you do? Because it's wintertime.
It's wintertime.
Warm up there. So yeah.
Yeah, you just need to keep moving.
All right. And how'd you get dried out then?
I was soaked until finish.
Oh, wow. But no frostbite or
no
anything
frostbite.
Like that.
It was a warmer year. I think the coldest was like 15 above, I think.
Oh, Fahrenheit. Right. Okay. Huh. Interesting. So that one, you got to put him on that, I believe. And other ones include the Res Pass 50. Talked about that. Oh, the Tanana River Challenge. That's another one that I'd be interested in learning about.
Tanana River Challenge, that year, I planned to do Susitna 100, but it was canceled because of the trail condition, snow condition.
Mm-hmm.
And I really missed this middle of nowhere, nothing but white.
There's a scene.
So I signed up for it. I think it was, let's see, probably a month or so before that, I broke my shoulder or the top of a humerus. So I couldn't use my right arm at all.
Uh-huh.
So my biggest goal in that race was not to fall.
Oh, right. And you're successful.
Yes.
Good. So that was the 50 mile or the 45 miles. Now, in your notes, you talk about the Grand Prix, Alaska Mountain Runners Grand Prix. What is that? And explain to what that is.
So Alaska Mountain Runners, I don't know if I can list everything now. The list is getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
But Crazy Lazy, Noia, Government Peak, Juno, Bird Ridge, Mount Marathon, Alieska Cirque, Matt Peak Challenge, and Veins of Gold. I might be missing something. But there are certain mountain races
mm-hmm.
that are Grand Prix races.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get, finish first place, you get certain point.
Ah, uh-huh.
And then second place, different point per placement. And then if you do more than four races, the highest four points that you got for the year will be counted and add the four numbers and compare the total. That makes sense.
Yep. And then who has the most points or least points? Is it most or least? I guess it'd be most.
Yes,
points,
most.
Wins.
Huh. Yeah. I've done four races actually only once.
Huh. Well, that sounds interesting. And have you placed in that? How have you done in that?
Yeah. That one year that I did four races, I won it.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Twardock. We have Meg Inokuma with me in the studio talking about her amazing running and peatbagging life and lifestyle, it sounds like. So we've been talking about training. We talked about your different records. I'm also interested in some other stuff you do, particularly your volunteer work with like AMRG, right? You've done some volunteering. Why do you do that? And what is enjoyable about that?
Yeah, I don't remember how I start getting into it. When I was in Flagstaff, in my first grad school, I did take Wilderness First Responder. I think I was just curious.
Okay.
Then when I was in Kodiak, I joined Kodiak Island Search and Rescue, and I was there in the group for 5 years. I moved here and, I joined Alaska Mountain Rescue Group.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in Kodiak Island Search and Rescue, my very first climbing partner in Japan, who I went high school and university together, she passed, likely in avalanche, end of December. The body wasn't found until May. But that added to my motivation to stay in search and rescue field.
Mm-hmm. But it didn't slow you down, apparently, that losing your friend.
No.
Because some people might have said, oh, this isn't worth it.
Good point. Right, yeah. Right, yeah. No, I didn't lose my motivation.
Right. And did that losing your friend, did that affect the risks that you took? Did you say, well, maybe I'm going to avoid avalanches, for instance? Or like, how did that, see what I'm saying?
Not that one, because I wasn't there. I did not go to Japan to go look for them. Mm-hmm. I think visual is pretty big. One of the missions that I've done, sometimes when I go peak-bagging, it gives me a flashback.
Oh, right. Huh.
And I feel, yeah, I don't know if I can do this because of that memory.
Right. And does that then you turn around when that happens, or do you you don't power through that feeling, right? And in the mountain, and speaking of which, there's some news out recently about the science of gut feelings, and how do you make decisions in the mountains in these races? Is it your gut feeling, or how do you decide when to turn around and when not to?
I stay calm. And more recently, I usually have a climbing partner. So we kind of check each other's temperature and, yeah, make group decision.
You've got this volunteer work and you've done a lot of other things with your life, I assume. But I'm also curious about what are some of the rewards? Like why do this? And maybe if you have a specific story or something of something that really stands out to you as a highlight.
Sure. I can talk about Resurrection Pass 50 in 2022 as a good example why I do this. That's the toughest race and the most satisfying race that I've ever done to this day. I always, when I race, I always try to give it my 100%. But for this race, by accident, I saw more than I felt like I gave 120% of what I had. I saw what I didn't know that I had. And that was very satisfying. The feeling that I gave it all is the reward for me.
Nice. And when do you know you've done that? Do you like collapse at the finish, or do you?
Pretty much.
right. And I guess my question is then, how do you prevent collapsing 5 miles from the finish? I mean, how do you balance that? Like, you want to give it all, but you don't want to give too much, right? Because at that point, you might bonk.
Anybody
who's done it is not a pleasant thing. I've done it, and it's the world slows down, and you're sort of done. So how do you manage that?
Good point. I don't know. It hasn't happened, but it might happen.
Oh, you haven't had that too?
I don't use a watch. Like, I don't check my heart rate, pace, any of that. I don't know. I don't have stats when I'm running. I just go by my feeling, always.
And so your feeling meaning your energy level, your aerobic capacity, like how, you must be judging it somehow, just your fatigue level.
Run however I want to.
But I guess I get back to this idea of like avoiding bonking, avoiding like crashing. Because it's important, especially in this mountain running stuff, to stay alert and literally stay on your toes so you're not tripping. And it happens to me all the time. I trip and do a face plant, and it's not great. So how do you manage that without a watch? I mean, people are so used to having these sports watches and judging everything, all the stats. Is it by, you say, how you're feeling, but is it how hard you're breathing, how hungry you are, how your fatigue level, so forth and so on? See what I'm getting at? There's got to be a way that you sort of judge.
I think I'm subconsciously thinking all of that. I think I'm good at listening to my body. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I cannot explain.
Yeah. Well, listen to your body. I mean, that does it. That does it pretty well. So what about the things? I mean, we talked about what you enjoy, what motivates you. What are some of the biggest challenges in this lifestyle of yours?
In the lifestyle? Good question. Time management.
Couldn't never end.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I cannot think of maybe for each one. I guess incorporating weather is a challenge.
Yeah. Weather. So how do you have rain here and you have equipment to deal with that? Bats of wildlife, moose and bears in particular, do you carry bear spray with you?
In peak bagging or in race?
Well, for training, for instance, for training for racing or peak bagging, yeah.
In peak bagging, I do.
Uh-huh. But not necessarily for training. Let's say we're going to do a training run on the hillside up here, and you're going to do a 12-mile loop. So you're not carrying pepper spray or bear spray?
I don't know which one I should call training.
Yeah.
Like my daily walk on lazy, I do not carry bear spray.
Yeah. We're about finished here. So what other suggestions do you have for people who might be thinking about getting into, let's start with mountain running and ultras?
I think having fun is the biggest factor.
Uh-huh.
One reason I don't use watch is I think if I had watch, I would start comparing myself with yesterday's myself and, I got to run faster or whatever, or you have to set goal each day. And that does not sound fun to me. I just want to go however I feel like. If I want to turn around after a mile, I'll turn around. Just keep it fun.
Uh-huh. What are your next steps? Do you have goals? Do you have things you want to accomplish in the next couple of years that you haven't done?
I'd like to get more peaks.
Yeah, I could finish 120, yeah.
That or any other peaks.
Right.
I don't know. I don't have a long-term goal. I'd like to finish Iditarod Trail Invitational at least once.
And finally, Meg, I want to know what inspires you.
I get inspiration from my daily life, from my friends. The other day, I was walking on lazy, and I ran into my friend, and I didn't go to lazy for about a month because of the breakup season. I don't want to damage the trail.
Yeah.
So I mentioned, I haven't seen you for a while. And she was like, I had an open heart surgery 6 weeks ago.
Wow.
And she's already there. That's inspiring.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I feel lucky that I get inspired from friends. Yeah.
That's excellent.
In my daily life.
That's an excellent story.
As far as ultra running, my biggest mentor and inspiration is Laura McDonough.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
She's not just what she's been doing, but who she is and how supportive she is to newbie like me.
Yeah.
And as far as from big races, I don't follow unless I have friends running, but there are three moments that I got inspiration from. One is 2023 when Courtney DeWalter broke a course record in Western State 100, and 3 weeks later, she broke a record in a Hard Rock 100. That was inspiring to see what human body can do.
Yeah.
And also this year, Rachel Entrekin broke the overall course record in Cocodona 250. That was amazing to watch.
Wow, men and women.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah.
And the third one, or the other one, is the moment when Jasmine Paris finished a Barkley marathon as the first and so far the only woman finishing ever since the race started in current format in, I think, 1995. She finished 99 seconds before 60 seconds cutoff. Yeah. And she literally collapsed after she finished. And I wanted to add some interesting episode related to this Jasmine's finish. My friend emailed me a few months ago. She watched one of the videos of Jasmine's finish for the first time, I think. And she mentioned that reminded me of me, which is humbling.
Yeah,
and it was interesting that my friend added that it was too bad that she needed to push herself so hard. And that was a very different perspective from how I saw. To me, the fact that she was able to push herself so hard was the inspiring part.
Nice. Yeah. That's what motivated you. Yeah.
Finishing is amazing, of course, but being able to push yourself so hard is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good. That's very impressive. We'll have a link to that video of her finishing that event on the Outdoor Explorer website. This has been Outdoor Explorer. I'm here with Paul Torlock. I've had Meg Inokuma with me in the studio. Thank you very much, Meg, for joining us today.
Thank you, Paul.
And we'll see everybody outdoors on the trail, pushing ourselves hard.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. Tobin Shelby is its producer, and the program is edited by Ammon Swenson and Crystal Hyde. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed on the show are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can listen to Outdoor Explorer anytime at alaskapublic.org and in your favorite podcast app. If you have a question, comment, or a topic suggestion, email outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org.